Would you let a stranger go through your phone? Probably not, right? I probably wouldn't either. Not like there's anything bad, really, but still. Everyone has secrets, and everyone wants privacy. New technologies are being created every day that invade and protect it. They collide to create things we could never dream of. People are using technology to break down old walls and to subvert governments, to throw all the old rules out the window.
LSD, cocaine, and ecstasy are now just a click of a mouse away. A new website sells illegal drugs to anyone who is willing to pay.
To get in, you need to download a program that hides your identity and prevents others from tracing you.
Users have been able to remain anonymous by using special routing and encryption software called Tor.
In January of 2011, a website was created. This is the story of that website. It took existing tools created for privacy and used them in an entirely new way. Its creator did a very clever thing and combined Tor, Bitcoin, and the ever-lucrative drug market. At the site's peak, it had hundreds of thousands of customers who bought and sold weed, fake passports, and all sorts of other illegal stuff. In fact, it was the first to do so, and pretty much set the template for the other darknet sites that followed. This episode, we're talking about the story of Silk Road. In some ways, Silk Road was an experiment in freedom. It made it as easy to order some hash as it was to buy a book on Amazon. But what would happen if Amazon hired hitmen to deal with HR problems? I'm EJ Fox, and you're listening to Metaverse, a podcast about humans, secrets, and the internet.
You know, all the drugs were broken down in very detailed fashion, half of which I've never heard of. So I thought, oh, well, a small amount of hash surely is not too bad.
I spoke to a reporter who wrote about how easy it was to buy drugs off the Silk Road.
My name is Carol Cadwallader. I'm a journalist and I write for the Guardian and Observer newspapers in the UK. So I just literally typed in silkroad.whatever it was, and that brought up the site. And it really did just look like eBay. A lot of my friends were like, what? You ordered illegal drugs to your own address? And I was like, oh, you know what it's like. In London, you live in these flats, which, you know, 100 people have lived in before practically. And so you're always getting posts with different people's names on. So to me, it didn't seem like a big risk. I just thought, well, I'll just use my own address and I just give a false name. A lot of people I knew were sort of like, oh, that seems very risky. I can't believe you did that. And whereas I felt foolishly sanguine about any risk involved. And it literally did, the envelope did literally arrive almost the next day, certainly not more than 2 days later.
Following Silk Road's launch, word is quickly spreading in certain circles about a site online where you can buy drugs and have them mailed to your house. Posts emerge on the ClearNet teaching people like Carol how to use Tor, buy Bitcoin, and get to the Silk Road. And lots of people do. Silk Road has vocal supporters that enjoy the security offered by Tor and Bitcoin. They seem to feel invincible. They're careful, but they also thumb their noses at the government.
It did have that element of you really are taunting the law enforcement agencies, aren't you? I mean, it's one thing to kind of carry out a massive illegal operation, but then I think to kind of flaunt it in their noses in the press.
Arrests are hardly heard of unless you're really careless, and people seem to know they're making history. Could Silk Road be a prototype and a new, safer way for society to approach drug use?
I'm of the legalise and tax it school of thought, to be honest with you. And I think if I had an 18-year-old kid, I would prefer they were buying drugs off the internet than they were kind of going out at midnight to some dodgy, you know, dark corner.
Just 5 months later, in the summer of 2011, Silk Road would get its first big press coverage and a serious bump in customers. Gawker writer Adrian Chen publishes an article called "The Underground Website Where You Can Buy Any Drug Imaginable." The article says Silk Road, quote, "resembles something from a cyberpunk novel." The attention helps Silk Road go mainstream, and thousands of new users flock to the site. It's like your local pizza place gets written up in the New York Times. Suddenly there are lines out the door.
I think I first heard about Silk Road around, it was right around the time when Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York, was making a big stink about Silk Road. And it was, you know, this was right after the article, I believe it was in Gawker, had come out saying that, you know, you could buy all kinds of drugs online. So yeah, my name is Sarus Farivar. I am the senior business editor at Ars Technica. I knew what Tor was, and I knew what Tor Hidden Services were, but it, you know, it honestly had never even occurred to me that somebody would try to build a website to sell drugs on it. And, you know, and it wasn't that hard to access, right? The URL for Silk Road was easily findable. I'm pretty sure Gawker published it.
It's around this time that Homeland Security begins monitoring some unusual drug seizures. They're noticing small quantities of drugs shipped through the mail. They find hits of acid or baggies of meth hidden in CD cases, bags of coffee, and other creative methods of stealth. The government is faced with a new type of online crime they've never fought before. They try to trace buyers and sellers, but actual arrests are rare. And anyway, new sellers pop up every day. This operation is unlike anything they've dealt with before in their careers. How are they going to shut it down? And who's running it?
I would bet money that there was nobody in federal law enforcement, probably, and certainly not, you know, there was probably nobody in law enforcement, federal or local or otherwise, that really had a strong handle on how to deal with Bitcoin, how to trace it, how to, you know, follow, you know, how it all works. And it was something that seemingly, you know, was sort of unstoppable. You know, it was using two very privacy-minded, cryptographically strong technologies, Tor and Bitcoin. Not only do you have this crazy kind of criminal enterprise story, not only do you have, you know, this criminal mastermind who has all of his notes and is doing all of this kind of stuff, they thought that the technology would protect them. They thought that they were the smartest guys in the room, and they couldn't imagine that anybody else would have the wherewithal to figure out what they were up to. I mean, I think it's a very kind of compelling story, right? There's this, I mean, first of all, it, you know, the character's name,
Silk Road, is run by a mysterious character who's named himself the Dread Pirate Roberts.
You know, Dread Pirate Roberts comes from a movie that is near and dear, I think, to a lot of people's hearts. I think it touches kind of a nostalgia and a kind of lore that people like. So DPR, Dread Pirate Roberts, comes from the movie The Princess Bride. And in The Princess Bride, this character is sort of this swashbuckling, good-looking, very suave, very smart kind of hero in the story. The whole, like, conceit of that is that it's passed from one person to the next.
Come on. Roberts had grown so rich, he wanted to retire. So he took me to his cabin, told me his secret. I am not the Dread Pirate Roberts, he said. My name is Ryan. I inherited the ship from the previous Dread Pirate Roberts, just as you will inherit it from me. The man I inherited from was not the real Dread Pirate Roberts either. His name was Cumberbund. The real Roberts has been retired 15 years and living like a king in Patagonia.
It's a brilliant move because from the beginning, it implies that DPR is more than one person.
Or to create, you know, at least some plausible deniability that, you know, it wasn't just him, right?
Was this enormous drug market run not by one guy, but passed person to person, all calling themselves the same name? The mystery around DPR is part of what I think makes this story so interesting.
And also, there's this idea that a lot of people have that I think is very kind of romantic and idealized, which is, you know, the lone hacker, you know, fighting the good fight against the big evil government.
DPR is seen as a countercultural hero, unstoppable. So arresting DPR and shutting down Silk Road would definitely make an agent's career. But despite the growing attention from law enforcement, Silk Road continues to prosper. The site gets a design refresh. It closes its weapons dealing section, which was bringing unwanted attention. DPR, its leader, is beginning to build a staff that he pays a salary, in Bitcoin, of course. The staff helps maintain the servers, settle disputes, and keep an eye out for law enforcement. They develop new techniques to avoid investigations, like private unlisted pages that don't appear in search results. They resolve user issues like lost passwords or packages that never show up, problems any online store has to deal with. But agents from the Department of Homeland Security and IRS were closing in. Things were about to get real for the Dread Pirate Roberts.
With something like this, you know, so you have to put yourself in the shoes of a federal investigator, you know, whether it's DEA or Secret Service or FBI or whatever. You know, all they know is that there's this, you know, illegal, obviously illegal drug website that's going on. They don't know where it's being operated from. They don't know who's doing it. They don't know how to get to him. And so I think a lot of federal agents in different parts of the country, most notably Baltimore and New York, are sort of sitting there scratching their heads, trying to figure out what the best way to go about, you know, getting at this guy is. So Carl Force, this DEA agent in Baltimore, is on what came to be known as the Baltimore Task Force. So there was this group of, you know, different law enforcement officials from different agencies. Force was from DEA, who were trying to kind of figure out how to get to DPR. So they were doing it, you know, in different ways, right? So Force is kind of trying to talk to him, right? Trying to go undercover and trying to get at him that way. Karl Marx Force operated on Silk Road under the pseudonym of Nob, N-O-B. And Nob told DPR, or made DPR sort of believe, that he was a kind of mid-level cartel operative, I think based in the Dominican Republic, but who had a lot of ties to organized crime and could move large quantities of drugs in and out of the U.S. The way he got DPR's attention to begin with was he offered to buy Silk Road, like from the beginning, and DPR sort of blew him off and said, all right, I'll sell it to you for $1 billion. So that didn't go anywhere, but I think it had the effect that Force wanted, which is that he wanted DPR to talk to him, and he wanted his attention, and that's what he got. And so by all accounts, the two of them became very, very sort of chummy. They talked frequently. They talked about, you know, the operations of the Silk Road, but they talked about women, they talked about movies, they talked about, you know, all kinds of things that, you know, random internet friends might talk about. And he says, you know, I'd really like to sell on Silk Road. I think it's great. But, you know, it's not worth my while to do such small time deals. You know, he's basically saying, look, I'm a wholesaler, right? I want to move large quantities. You know, this is a waste of my time to sell, you know, I think they're in one of the chat logs, he says it's like not worth my time to do under 10 kilos or something like that.
Now DPR is dealing with this new guy, Nob, who he doesn't really know. But he sees this new person, seemingly a member of a cartel, as an opportunity to expand. DPR must have known the risks, but he went ahead with the deal. He put a trusted member in charge of the arrangements, a guy calling himself Flush.
So DPR makes some arrangements, and the person on his staff, who it turns out is making those arrangements, it goes by the name of Flush and is Curtis Green in Utah, in Spanish Fork, Utah. And Curtis Green is this, you know, middle-aged guy, really into poker, who ends up being, for whatever reason, ends up being the one who gives his address in Utah to Nob to be the one who's going to receive this supposed cocaine. Green is essentially acting as the sort of middleman here to receive it, and then he's going to send it on to somebody else who we don't actually know still now, who went by the name Google. I think it's googly-eyed and then the number one, googly-eyed one, something like that. And they basically set up a controlled delivery of what, you know, looks like cocaine, but I'm pretty sure wasn't actually cocaine. Green takes receipt of it, tears it open, and as soon as he does that, he gets rushed by a number of federal agents in his house in Spanish Fork, Utah, and
this is as close as law enforcement has ever gotten to the Silk Road. It's a big break. Curtis Green, aka Flush, was a medium-ranked staff member. The feds needed to flip him and try and get a step closer to arresting DPR and shutting down Silk Road. If you've seen any cop TV show, then you know the drill. You start with the small fish and you work your way up. The feds have gotten their big break with the arrest of a Silk Road staff member. Now it's time to start grilling him.
Force walks in, having watched this from across the street, and starts talking to Green. Meanwhile, Green is really freaked out because he knows that if he disappears off of Silk Road, he was like a kind of a mid-level administrator dealing like with, he was like a customer service agent, basically. He's worried that if DPR finds out that he's been arrested, that he's going to, you know, have him killed or, you know, do something terrible to him and his family. DPR knows who he is and knows who everybody else who is staff on Silk Road, because it turns out DPR required that everybody send every you know staffer send, you know, scans of their identity document as sort of a way to keep track of them and frankly as a way to have leverage over them. And Green immediately starts cooperating with the government. Curtis Green is in a hotel conference room in Salt Lake City with a bunch of federal agents and his lawyer for something like 12 hours or more. And he's showing them how Silk Road works. He's showing them how to log in. I think he's just showing them kinds of the side of Silk Road that they couldn't see, information that he as an administrator had access to, the kinds of interactions that he had with DPR, and at some point, Sean Bridges leaves not very long after that, within, a couple hours of that, large amounts of Bitcoin start to be transferred from different Silk Road accounts, from different dealers and Silk Road's own accounts, passing through Curtis Green's account, being transferred to Curtis Green's account, and then being transferred elsewhere. So it appears that Curtis Green is the one that is controlling for a brief time different accounts and transferring large amounts of Bitcoin out of Silk Road. I believe they had this meeting on like a Friday. I think this happened on like a Friday afternoon into the evening, and then it wasn't until like the next day that they had fully realized what was happening. That we also know kind of what was happening from DPR's perspective, because we have again the chats that DPR was having with people who he believed were his allies, including including Knob.
DPR is now faced with his first real crisis as a leader. He has this staff member, somebody entrusted with this big 10-kilo deal, who's missing. Not only that, but he appeared to be stealing from sellers and the Silk Road itself. And by the time anyone noticed, he'd stolen over $250,000 in Bitcoin. As DPR's heart raced with betrayal, he messaged his confidants and the staff of Silk Road. He was at a loss and in search of guidance. What should he do? It's just his bad luck that one of those confidants was Knob, the undercover identity of DEA agent Carl Force.
And he's telling Knob that, who is Carl Force, that, he believes that this guy Curtis Green stole this money, and DPR has a conversation with another one of his lieutenants, who essentially goads him into saying, look, you've got to have an iron fist and da-da-da, and like you have to show them who's boss and you have to show them that you're serious, and if you're really committed to this business, you've got to be ruthless. And so DPR decides that he's going to kill Green, or he's going to order Green to be killed.
DPR chats with another staff member, telling them, if this was the Wild West, and it kinda is, you'd get hung just for stealing a horse. It's at this point the character of DPR changes. He's less hacker revolutionary and more drug kingpin. It makes you wonder if those posts about a safe alternative to the drug war was just cynical PR. Or maybe having millions of dollars pass through your hands just changes you. DPR doesn't even completely realize it yet, but things are already spiraling out of control. He pays Bitcoin, $80,000 worth, to Knob for the hit on Green. He gives his newly hired hitman a random series of numbers to write on a piece of paper, and demands a photo of it with the dead body as proof of completion. For Agent Carl Force in the investigation, it's an incredible stroke of luck.
Nob, who had, as I said before, built up this relationship with DPR, finds himself not only where DPR is turning to him to conduct a hit, or what, you know, DPR believes is a hit, but the target of the hit is a guy, Curtis Green, who he's literally in the same room with, you know, at the same time, and that he literally has basically full control over. I mean, Green will do anything that Force tells him to do at that point. And so what eventually happens is with Force's help, they orchestrate this, fake murder on Curtis Green's, bathroom floor, and Curtis Green had been a paramedic. So he, I guess, had some knowledge into how dead bodies are supposed to look. So, you know, he got his hair wet and he lay down, and they, I guess, threw some Campbell's soup to simulate vomit and took these pictures of him and sent those to DPR. And DPR believed that Nob had done what he had asked them to do.
The hit DPR ordered on Curtis Green was his first, but it wasn't his last. In total, DPR allegedly ordered 5 murders, including at one point the roommates he lived with. I think it may be a case of life imitating art. Sometimes the chats from DPR read like he's watched too many movies. Where else do you learn how to run an illegal drug operation, anyway? In a different case, he's talking to an alleged Hell's Angel with the name Red and White. He's ordering a hit on someone trying to blackmail him. "I'd like to put a bounty on his head, if it's not too much trouble for you," he asks. "What would be an adequate amount to motivate you?" We see in the chat logs that have been released that DPR is repeatedly willing to kill to protect his business. And for him, there's no problem that can't be solved by spending more Bitcoin, including frequent payoffs to hackers and blackmailers. He has more Bitcoin than he knows what to do with. Plus, the value of a Bitcoin is rising along with the popularity of Silk Road. In the summer of 2011, around when Silk Road was founded, the price of a single Bitcoin is $9. 2 years later, when DPR is paying what he thinks are the Hell's Angels for a hit, a Bitcoin is worth $90, and DPR had a lot of them. According to the FBI, Silk Road generated almost 10 million Bitcoins, that's Bitcoins, not dollars, and revenue for their sellers. And from that, Silk Road collected over 600,000 Bitcoins as commission. In 2013, and again in 2016, the price of a Bitcoin hit $900. Not $9, not $90, $900. And it's gotten even higher. At that value, Silk Road's revenue would match companies like eBay, GameStop, or Netflix. Not only did DPR have a lot to protect, he had no problem throwing around Bitcoin to just try and solve his problems.
Because I think that speaks to the kind of person that he was at that time. And the links that he was willing to go to protect his vast criminal enterprise. You know, I'm just not sympathetic to somebody like that. I would be willing to, you know, hear the harm reduction argument if, you know, he was somebody who was sort of benevolent and was making this website for the purposes of like education or maybe even charity. Like if he was, you know, running it not as a business, but as like a nonprofit or some sort of, you know, bizarre underground charity or something. But that's not what he was doing. It was designed from the beginning as a money-making operation for him. And it was very successful. I mean, he made what, hundreds of millions of dollars? It wasn't just like a one-off whim. Like this was like an ongoing, extensive, sophisticated conspiracy, set up for the purpose of benefiting him. And that's it. I don't really understand how else you can see it. I mean, I think you can argue that the drug war is overbroad. You can argue that it's a waste of money. You can argue that drug sentences are perhaps distributed unfairly. But to say that he was somehow this, you know, great guy who only wanted to reduce people's harm when they were doing drugs and wanted to provide a means to do that, I think that's ludicrous. It was set up as a financial enterprise for the purpose of benefiting him, plain and simple. You know, I think he had this belief and perhaps even a blind faith that, you know, Tor and PGP and Bitcoin would protect him. He could not even imagine that federal agents had infiltrated his site I don't think he conceived of the fact that, like, somebody would raid him or arrest him in person. I mean, it baffles me. The thing that one of my favorite kind of factoids about the case is the fact that he was questioned by Homeland Security, I think it was Homeland Security Investigations, after the United States Postal Service had intercepted a package of several, I think maybe more than a dozen, fake ID cards that he had ordered with his own picture on it. Different fake IDs, you know, from different countries and different places, driver's licenses, national ID cards and such. And he gave some statement like, oh, well, anybody can order stuff off Silk Road. And it baffles me to no end that at the moment that he literally had a federal agent talking to him, that he didn't, like, attempt to leave the country immediately.
It appears like DPR was facing more than he could handle. But the way he was caught was entirely unexpected. In the next episode of Metaverse, we'll finish our story and tell you how the government eventually shut down Silk Road and arrested the person they claim is DPR. By the way, if you want to see the photos that Force sent to DPR of Curtis Green's fake death, plus other links and, you know, visual stuff that I couldn't put on the show, you can check them out on the show's website. You can find it at metaverse.audio. That's metaverse.audio. In the meantime, you know, I'd love to know what you think of the show, or if there's any stories you want me to take a look at. You can tweet at the show at Metaverse Audio, or directly at me at Mr. EJ Fox. That's M-R-E-J Fox. And if you listen to podcasts, you've probably heard this a trillion times, but if you like the show, it really makes a huge difference if you go to iTunes and give it a rating. It's the main way people find out about other shows, and personally, it would mean a lot to me, so thank you.